I'm Tim Ventura, here with John Hutchison from Vancouver, B.C. John has been working on a variety of new technologies over the years. He's most well known for the Hutchison effect, which is actually a collection of very unique effects that are currently either unexplained or poorly explained by science. John, can you hear me okay?
I can hear you perfectly, Tim. Pleasure talking with you.
Great. Well, thanks for your time. I definitely wouldn't miss the opportunity to interview you. You have some of the most unique effects in science as far as the Hutchison effect, to begin with. It's a much larger scale than anything else out there, and it's also more unique. It has more facets than probably anything else that I've seen. Could you tell me a little bit about what the Hutchison effect actually is or what it would be exhibited as?
Well, sure, Tim. It started way back in 1980 when I made a chance discovery after replicating a lot of Tesla's work and other scientists' work back in that time period. I mean, basically, to try and put it simply, it's the Hutchison effect named by scientists around the world back at that time period, actually. Happens to deal with momentary levitation of any materials from a few ounces to up to about 1,500 pounds was tested by Boeing in 1989.
Oh, okay.
And it also includes effects happening at a distance from the equipment, such things as metal going transparent, metal going into rubbery kind of materials, and into unknown compositions of alloys and this kind of thing, is some of the aspects of the Hutchison effect.
Well, it's very unique. Yeah, at one point, I actually had a short piece of video. You did a lot of filming in the 1980s with some of the most obvious and larger scale effects, and I had maybe a 15-second clip, and it almost looked like it was backwards. So I played the tape backwards, and it actually looked backwards both ways. And I actually believe, if I'm not mistaken, that was taken during the time or around the time you've been working with the U.S. government. Didn't they send up a research team to work with that?
Yes, that was approximately 1983. It was a four-month program that the Reagan administration was highly interested in it because they felt that the Soviet Union was doing something similar. So we worked away at that and had all kinds of effects happen. However, on their records or the videotapes, they say that nothing happened and attributed the effects to decay, which is just basically government was watching it if they're interviewed on TV and that kind of thing. So that was that. And then, of course, they went back to Los Alamos National Laboratories, where the colonel was rather upset over the whole incident. Plus a team from Los Alamos, and then calling Douglas Aerospace Corporation to do a secondary test, which was not classified, and I had the videos and test results. But it was, again, what we watched as decay. And then after that, the Canadian government, and then after that, the German government, and then Boeing Aerospace, and so on and so forth. So, I've had my adventures in that area anyhow.
Yeah. It's the explanation of PK or psychokinesis really, in some ways, doesn't seem to hold. It's such a large-scale effect. And more recent investigations, like I know that Nick Cook had dropped by a while ago and interviewed you, kind of indicate a renewed interest and kind of a belief that this is something that is really based on your expertise and your knowledge of these systems and not some strange, unexplained psychic effect that might be being amplified.
Yeah, that's so basically true. I mean, I don't know. Well, I guess the government wants to protect whatever interests. I don't know why they're simply calling it PK. We're still after the Canadian government's report back in 86. They did send up part of the report. It was a matter of national security, according to my member of parliament.
Sure.
And I didn't get the videos back yet, but I'm pressing the issue by posting on the forum, fantastic forum, all the names and that of the scientists in Ottawa, Canada, that were involved. And because I do wish to have those videos added to my collection of interesting videos, I guess you'd call it.
Well, one of the the things that surprised me was when I talked to you a few days ago, you mentioned that you were actually unable to turn the equipment up to full power and really demonstrate the effect because you now have all of your equipment actually stored in an apartment. And by doing so, it actually creates effects throughout the entire apartment complex.
Yeah, not only that, I found out later during a TV show that it actually carries on within a city block or two. And unfortunately, a tenant above me here had to be taken away by the New Westminster Police Department because he's ranting and raving that they got technology down there and they got camera people down there. And unfortunately, the poor guy was taken away by the police. And that was when I did an experiment with Griffin Films when I was trying to levitate a toy UFO. I had to put on it at that time a string, actually, and then just got some random effects. But prior to that, I was able to actually levitate the thing when I had less equipment in here without any strings attached, so to speak. And it was quite an impressive levitation for Fox Television. But as more equipment comes in here, of course, then all the fields get jammed. And even the access to the equipment to operate everything, it's impossible by the time you try and set anything up. You're totally exhausted, and of course the fields are not the same. I think it's my prolific collection of media equipment that has interfered in the area of this research and also in the apartment. So it's every time I turn the equipment on, guess who's not? The Westminster Police Department.
Unfortunately, yeah. Do you think there's a possibility you might be able to move back into another lab in the future and start doing some larger scale effects?
Oh, I'd love to do that. I'd like to get out of this place. How can you explain it? It's not the best for also spiritual growth in this kind of environment.
Oh, sure. I'm sorry. I'm disagreeing with you. Yeah, and, you know, the size and just the proximity to people makes it difficult. But, you know, if one of the ideas that had popped into my mind was maybe a tractor trailer, and then you could, you know, drive it to wherever and have the equipment already set up. Not sure if that would be a good idea. Or maybe just, you know, another lab, somewhere that's a little bit more remote, and whatever strange effects that happen could really be kind of identified in an environment without the surrounding population.
Very well. But point there, Tim, because that's what I used to do before I went off to Germany for those 2 years. The main lab was stolen basically by the Canadian government when I was away in Germany. And we were doing experiments and analysis of all the metal samples in Germany, and they had expressed their interest in the Hudson effect equipment. But to move out would be quite a thing. Of course, you need a lot of funding to do it.
Oh, sure. Then you have tons and tons, quite literally several tons of equipment.
Well, more like I guess 6 or 8 tons. Although the mayor of New Westminster expressed high interest in this when all heck broke loose last year in regard to my balcony and radiation stuff and everything else there. That turned into quite a actually interesting adventure, and it was publicized on Art Bell's radio show with a JPEG image of the infamous balcony. So, but it got the mayor's attention. He looked into some of the background work I did and knew some of my friends for 30 years and basically expressed interest in trying to get a location for me.
Well,
that hasn't transpired yet, so I don't know. I've been getting a lot of interesting emails from folks in the United States that would like to set me up down there, which I wouldn't mind doing.
Yeah.
Demonstrate some of the interesting effects again.
Yeah, one of the advantages of, if you're able to recreate some of the effects that I've seen, and again, coming from a very brief clip of footage that seems to make it back onto the TV channels quite regularly now, is, you know, it shows a bowling ball levitating. One of the most impressive was a glass of water spontaneously lifting off. But the interesting thing for me was not only does the glass lift off and fly away, but the water actually lifts off out of the glass. So you actually have two objects accelerating at different speeds out of the picture frame. But, you know, that and then room temperature spontaneous melting. There's really no better word for it, of metals. It just, you know, incredible effects. These are things that, you know, having worked with the lifter technology, I've seen some very interesting things, but nothing of this scale, and nothing even remotely close. The most I've seen as I've said before, I've had 1 pound of payload on my 4 foot lifter, and I've had it 10 feet up in the air, and it flies very well. But I've never had a bowling ball spontaneously lift off, which is, to my mind, just incredibly amazing stuff.
I feel it's an iron ball. I mean, different TV people get the story mixed up with what 70-pound cannonball.
Oh, okay, okay.
It's floating around, but also there's no connections during the real Hutchinson effect experiments. There's no direct connections or any magnetic fields below or over top the test object. It's all done at a distance and up to, it was measured out at 300 feet away, the effects even happen. That was by a Los Alamos National Labs staff member.
Well,
measured something at about 300 feet from the main test area.
One of the things that I've had, and again, this is just kind of an opinion from having seen a lot of the footage, is having read a fair amount about scalar fields and, having read some of Tom Bearden's work and some of the other popular literature about scalars, one of the things that it would appear like, based on, in some ways, the almost random effects that happen with the Hutchinson effect are one of the limitations, I guess, again, for a populated area is the unpredictability of it. And it seems like these scalar fields, based on factors that I clearly don't understand, really seem to overlap and increase and then cause these effects in very specific areas. Do you have any idea about predicting them for the future or any way to really, any methods for controlling or enhancing them?
I had actually in the late 80s a lot of control mechanisms for controlling the fields, and they were pretty constant. They would sometimes work away on an object for, about 15 minutes. So I have a rough idea on what is needed, because when I started out in this, it was very random, and I'd only get maybe some effects that were dramatic maybe within many hours. Then as time progressed, and I got more involved with replicating a lot of the machinery into more advanced stuff like vacuum tube technology and RF fields work and electrostatic works, so I started to get more consistent limitations and effects and stuff like that.
Well, the big question, I guess, myself being somewhat of an inventor, and I know that there are inventors all over the world that are just, consistently amazed by your work, is if someone wanted to pursue this, what kind of equipment would they need and what kind of, not really just the methodology, but, what's the thought process that you go through when you're creating these effects?
Well, okay, when I started way out back in 1979 and through the 70s, I was replicating all the Tesla's machines just because it was interesting to me, with no expectations until, I turned the stuff on at night and observed the interesting lightning effect from the static generators and also the Tesla coil. So I would recommend in starting out basically with Tesla technology and high voltage DC work along with electrostatics, and you'll see that there's some interesting effects that happen. So you have to work your way into it like I did over a long period of time.
Well, a lot of
the equipment and field shaping equipment and static technology and that.
A lot of the work that you've done involves different frequencies. Have you found a correlation? Do you think there might be a magic frequency if people were shooting for this to attempt to work with, or maybe a collection of frequencies to shape the fields?
Oh, yes, for sure. There's the fields I started to use way back then were 450 kilocycles, RF, CW. Then I went into 750 kilocycles Tesla waves, scalar type tech. It was a constant voltage out and radio frequencies, I should say, also. But it was very strong and intense and not visible sparks because sparks cause problems. And then, of course, I had around 14 megacycles. we had a lot of fun with the measurements of the fields and that. And but we found out that the RF itself is not the main operators of anything. It's a combination of them that seems to open up some type of dimensional doorway or effect with gravity that seems to twist it and bend it around where it puts a shield across anything and stuff will take off into the air. Which interested McDonald's, that was to the point where they felt that they can actually put a focus field and have a lifting craft unto itself, but they're, for some reason, and I have this all in writing, of course, is that they somehow couldn't find the funding, and I honestly think, and my business partners felt that they just simply ran with the technology into black operations, which, you know, I'm not into conspiracy theories that much, but then again, you know, you hear so many different things over and over again.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's also, you know, one of the things that's been very interesting is that, and again, with the lifter technology that I've been working with a lot, it's a very linear effect. The output thrust is very closely related to the input power and the size of the device. And in some ways, I've wondered, you know, even though you're working with large levels of power, it's still difficult to really visualize, you know, how, you know, a few hundred watts or several thousand watts would lift a 70 or 80 pound cannonball. And so I thought, you know, perhaps it is a dimensional doorway, a gateway to someplace else, or maybe just shifting things a little bit outside of space-time so that the effects don't work quite the same way. You think it might be related to Eugene Ponkonoff's work in Tampere, Finland?
I think it closely goes along that way, and also Rene Louis Vallée, who is a nuclear scientist working with Andrei Sakharov, in the 1980s put out a paper for Paris Technologies, the company that I was working with, which was George Hadley and Alex Pizarro, mentioning about space-time being twisted and bent. This paper was about 4 pages and was of great interest to the U.S. government.
Oh, okay.
Get that posted sometime on the Internet.
Yeah, definitely. And, well, in terms of equipment now, you mentioned Tesla coils, and those are, if I remember correctly, at least a few hundred thousand volts, right? And then you also use a DC overlay where you have, is it just a static field or, you know?
I would use a high output electrostatic to fill a whole area with electrostatics, but then again, that doesn't explain why the effects happen outside of the laboratory and into other people's buildings and that.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Street. Now, I was just doing something for fun a couple of weeks ago, and I was playing around some of the equipment here, and I had a car alarm going off for about an hour until the police came around, and I shut everything off and just walked out the door and went downstairs, but I couldn't resist the temptation, of course.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, it's amazing stuff. And, you know, one of the real advantages that you have is you've been able to buy a lot of stuff at the Navy Surplus up in B.C. And you know, as a result, like I've seen a radar dish in your lab on a Discovery Canada show that Peter and Shira von Putkammer filmed. An amazing device that most people definitely wouldn't have in their apartment. But,
yeah. Oh, my goodness, yes. Sure, I'm the Dr. Frankenstein here. I'm lucky they haven't come around with torches yet to bring down the castle, so to speak. Because I've done some crazy stuff here. I had a toy flying saucer thing. Same one on Discovery Canada. That I attached a high voltage wire to it and had it fly, flipping around in here. I had a take-up spool on it, though, that the live wire wouldn't hit anything and cause a fire. Even that, unto itself, caused a local constabulary to come knocking on my door because I guess it causes RFI interference and that kind of thing. So.
Sure. Well, one of the mitigating factors, though, has to be not only has the U.S. military been intensely interested in this, Nick Cook from James Defense Review, one of the most prestigious publications, when he was doing research of his own, you know, people at Lockheed had showed him the tape, and the interview that I'd seen with him was surprising because, you know, he was very impressed not only by seeing the tape, but that it was being shown to him by someone at Lockheed, which kind of further illustrated that in kind of the very high-tech development circles and, you know, unfortunately some of the black ops circles as well. You know, your research is definitely something that they're aware of and keep a focus on.
Oh, that's without question. I mean, I've had so many contacts over the years from different people in black ops. I don't know why it wound up in the hands of Lockheed Martin Skunk Works people, but I'd get such notations from Colonel Oliver North and all sorts of high-profile characters back in the Eastern Seaboard. And also overseas, too. A lot of letters and people coming, actually a lot of interesting people have come here, including a congressman, Berkeley Bedell, who's into alternative health. He was here visiting or talking, and he has a high interest in my research. And so I've had a lot of high-ranking characters come and go out of here, out of this tiny apartment, and also back in the old lab.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Well,
I'll hear a siren in the background. I don't think I have anything turned on, do I?
No. That's
no.
Fine. Yeah. Yeah, you know, I actually have a couple of contacts of my own who have expressed interest in, you know, they thought, you know, if John ever has the time and they're over in Vancouver, they've actually thought about planning a trip up there, which in some ways, you know, I don't know, it must seem strange to have people dropping by from all over the world, but at the same time, it's so unique and so unexplained and so different. Well, in terms of your equipment, then, so you're using, you mentioned you had a 200,000 volt, probably, was that DC or AC generator?
That would be direct current. Well, the main transformers had about 14 of them, and they were direct current, and also several were AC. Now, these things were available at circuits. Now, I have here up to maybe 100,000 volts I could produce, and then it's the electrostatic for the effects I did have here. But prior to that, these transformers weighed in at 1,500 pounds to 2 tons. And they were just simply things that were available for me to have for nothing, really.
Oh, okay. Well,
they were really just the right moment, the right times, and these were big X-ray transformers that had DC output from them, which helped a lot in the latter part of the 1980s. Although smaller sizes would work just as well, but with just what was available from the scrap yards.
Well,
and also I did so much of my own engineering that machining of parts and pieces, you know, too, like I do here. And some of this is displayed in a journal called Electric Spacecraft Journal.
You mentioned that, and that was Charles Yost published that, wasn't he?
Yes, he published those results that I gave him. I'm thinking it goes back past 1995. And the recent request for those drawings, I do have the magazine around somewhere, but they're really well-made drawings.
Oh,
of the electrostatic generators, Tesla coils, and interferometers that I made.
Well, and it's kind of yet another piece of the puzzle for other experimenters out there trying to find their own version of this effect, or, you know, if nothing else, replicate it and show that it's not psychokinetic, that it's actually a real effect, and that you were able to do it because you had years of experience in working with this equipment.
That's right, and I'm just hoping that, you know, maybe somebody out there that goes into these journals can actually get the diagrams and maybe put up a website or just publish a diagram all over the place. I have George Hathaway's diagrams, and then I have McDonnell Douglas Aerospace diagrams, and then my own diagrams, which I sent into Charles Yost for publication as a magazine.
Oh, okay. So there's actually a lot of information out there, and I've seen your website. I can't remember offhand what the URL is.
Tim, I just got involved in computers a couple of years ago, and I didn't even know what an icon was, believe it or not. And I still don't know how to make a website. It's just everybody else will still kindly put up websites on yours, truly.
Well, yeah, including myself. I actually have a page on the Hutchison Effect, and I get emails all the time about it. You know, people from all over the world saying, you know, what's the key or what's the secret? And I have to write back and say, you know, I have no clue. It's amazing, whatever it is. And, you know, it definitely seems like a scale of potential. And unfortunately, in some ways, that's, you know, an area of research that doesn't seem to have a lot of information.
Yeah, unfortunately, all the information, Tim, is in boxes here, and water tight containers. It's all paper documentation.
Okay.
And videos stuck. You know, I got tons and tons of videos that nobody's ever seen this stuff of levitation and experiments. Also, the scientific papers that, you know, it's a matter of trying to find somebody that is willing to go through the stuff and put it out, record it out, and put it on the internet. Won't make it. There's talk of a major film on yours truly, but I don't know when that will be. But the potential for a fantastic information site at least is available, but again, it's transferring it to all the paper documentation out there. I mean, I got megatons of this stuff here. Quite interesting, even on other people's work, like Tom Beard and stuff. I'm right from Washington, D.C. I'm actually getting out of a database, stuff that people don't even know about. I had this contract with the U.S. government, and it gave me a privilege of putting me on your mailing list at DTIC, the SBIR program, and I got all the neat stuff, you know, over all the years since the 80s, and it's a shame that so much of this stuff is just sitting here.
Yeah, well, and one of the things that would be interesting is if someone could scan this stuff together and put it on a, you know, an internet library of sorts for your video and documentation. You know, I have to wonder if people going through that and reading the different documents might find some keys or some new ideas, things that, you know, might have never occurred to you because you're so close to the equipment, you know, that by taking a step back and having the third party look at it. And again, not military scientists who are very rigorously trained in conventional physics, but actual inventors, you know, people who are calculated risk takers, I guess.
So there's a lot here. I mean, there's a lot of photographs, there's a lot of drawings, documents. Some of it is heavy physics from René Louis Vallée of France and Sakharov. But again, there's the simplistic diagrams that McDonnell Douglas Aerospace Corporation and my own diagrams that I drew in to Charles Yeltsin that would be quite helpful to a lot of people.
Yeah, well, you know, in terms of the effect, and again, I've seen things levitating, I've seen metals melting. Have there been anything else? You'd mentioned at one time, I believe, some minor time effects. I'm not sure if that's true or not. But.
Oh, time distortion effects, yes. We've had those happen quite a bit, too. We've had entire things that appeared through the Max Planck Institute in Fraunhofer Labs. They were able to determine that this metal samples were through some kind of time distortion. The Canadian government's analysis of the 8mm film that Hathaway and myself and others took shows that some of the metal pieces are transparent. You can see through them. And this is the old Super 8mm film. So there's a lot of different things that are quite interesting. Also, background radiation is reduced to a couple of counts per minute. We saw that it backed out in, oh, good heavens, 1989. When I was working with the Boeing group, yet another group. And that's also the time they managed to levitate a 1,500-pound transformer at least an inch off the floor. And that video, unfortunately, I don't have. We broke company, and I went off to Germany by invitation by Dr. Peter Kokoschnik, who's quite a brilliant scientist, who basically did find ZTE energy fluctuations, and I was a guest at his villa in Hendorf in the state of Salzburg, Austria. So a lot has happened in regards to people going over stuff and testing and analyzing everything. And again, it's a shame that it's just sitting here, and a lot of famous scientists' names should be recognized also. I feel that helped in helping me in the research.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and it's in some ways, there's so much to it that it almost has to be a collaborative effort where, you know, you have these results that realistically the data might not be completely analyzed for a century or more. You know, it's really kind of a whole new branch of science. So right there in your apartment.
It is, and I'd be happy even to have it on display somewhere, all of the papers and metal samples and because I've got barrels of metal samples down in the locker room here also that I feel I'd be happy to have them on display somewhere.
Oh. Yeah,
even don't need them. Don't need them. You know, I got my samples I take for traveling on lecture tours, but they have a place where you can actually display these things on a wall with all the test results along with it. Papers would be fantastic.
Well, you know, one thing that I've never heard asked, and it could just be because I, you know, just didn't hear that particular interview, but have you ever had anything dangerous happen? You know, I mean, one of the things that I've worried about is working with scale and potentials. Since the overlap areas of potential can really appear in random places, I'd almost wondered what would happen if one of those appeared, you know, inside the human body or you know, in a brick over someone's head or something. Have you ever had anything kind of close calls like that happen?
I myself did. It was like if I'm kind of visualizing, I had like having my arm stuck in a whirling pool of mercury or something like that. That's what it felt like. I'm trying to go by visualization and density of metals. And I happened to move my arm around to another knob on the main control panel in one of the big labs, and this effect happened. It felt like something was swirling around my arm, and it kind of hurt. But that's the only incident. I mean, we have television people in the big labs filming stuff. Their only concern was would their cameras get exploded, and they checked it through their engineers, and they said, no, it should be okay. So we did many TV live demos like that on Canadian News. BC TV with Alan Edwards and Tony Parsons and CKVU Television and CBC. Nothing happened to any of us. And also the scientists, we seem to be all in good health, along with my partner, George Hathaway, who, by the way, is actually writing a book on the Hutchison effect.
Oh, okay. And okay. Do you know what it would be called when he releases it?
I believe the Hutchison effect by George Hathaway.
Oh, okay. So rather obvious title then.
I'm kind of excited about that. I'm not sure how the context is going to be about, but he's doing all the analysis and stuff of more samples I gave him when he visited here just a couple months ago. And I actually just traded some surplus equipment for him. I gave him a couple of metal samples to take back east there for him to analyze. So.
Well, one thing that I'd like to ask is, you know, now that you're using the internet and you know, collaborating with others in news groups, as myself and a lot of other inventors are, one of the big questions is: are you really seeing hints from people's descriptions and internet videos and things, seeing hints of maybe the Hutchison effect on a smaller scale in other people's work, or things that are kind of reminiscent? You know, the thing with the sometimes I'll see something in the back of my mind that'll make me think, you know, this really seems like it's tied together with something else. And I know that Bill Alec just released a video on Mystery Spot, and there have been a lot of other videos and just reported claims and effects online. Have you ever come across anything and thought, well, you know, this might be a component, or it reminds me somewhat of something I've seen?
Like an interview last night there, I listened to there. It was, you're talking about spark gaps, and that was kind of interesting. My ears perked up about spark gap tech because I had the same kind of work with my spark gaps if I adjust of them. And the energy potentials in your lifter tech is quite interesting unto itself, so it's getting me very close in there, I feel, with what you guys are doing.
Well, you know,
covering a lot of neat stuff there, and I was quite fascinated by listening to that. Good interview, and wow, that's interesting. What is podcast and what you guys are achieving? Quite impressive.
I definitely appreciate it. One of the things that surprised me somewhat is, and it was something I didn't notice at first, the lifters do seem to have side effects, and it's one of those things that very few people like to report. We did testing with a shielded magnetometer, and we were unable to pick up the Earth's magnetic field while the lifter was operating, and we also had some unexplained signals in the background. And it's one of those things where when you mention it online, reports start pouring in from people all over the world saying, you know, I had this happen and I can't really explain it. It's not really something that happens all the time. You know, another thing that I had happen, interestingly, was I've had sparks that appear out of nowhere. And in a way, they're almost not really bound in time at all. When I operate the lifter consistently for several days on end, I can turn it off, but there's a period of a week or so where I'll get unexplained electromagnetic effects. Yeah, and they're uncommon enough and they're random enough that there's no really way to pin them down. But I've wondered if maybe you know, with on a much smaller power scale, if lifters might tie into some of the same effects that you've seen.
Oh, I would definitely say it may do in some areas. Would be surprised sometimes when it's going to discover something happening somewhere else. And when you mentioned about the energy in that, too, I remember when the lab was turned off, our main lab, that we always had test equipment. So I turned on a spectrum analyzer, and good heavens, it seemed to be a source of energy still there, and it slowly dissipated over a half hour. And I know that all the main plasma capacitors were discharged and everything else was rested. And I was just scratching my head over that one.
Oh, well, it's interesting that you mentioned that. One of the things that I usually don't like to talk about was when we had the magnetometer we were testing, the Earth's magnetic field didn't appear, and this was in about a 12-foot radius, I think, for about 15 minutes after we turned the lifter off. And we had done the same thing. We walked away scratching our heads. We tested it three or four times. We would run the lifter for about 5-10 minutes and turn it off, you know, and there were no static effects in the area. I have very good discharge equipment, and I have a good discharge probe, and everything was shut down, cold. I was actually working on the lifter one of the times, repositioning it, so there was no residual that I could tell. But at the same time, about 15 minutes later, the magnetometer would start beeping again, and the beeping indicated that it could detect this magnetic field. The strange thing was, this thing was between 6 and 8 feet away from the lifter, and we tested in a variety of positions, and we just couldn't pin down what it would be. It didn't seem to be static because, again, it was meant for high voltage experiments. It was shielded against static. Although at the same time, you know, it's not impossible that it could have been effective.
Interesting that you influence with geomagnetic field here, although it is rather weak in a way. Perhaps something was pressing it and pushing it away. Although electrostatics do affect magnetic fields. It kind of reminds me of, when you were talking about that, kind of reminds me of when the equipment in the large lab that turns on the background radiation would drop considerably down to a few pounds per minute. So I did a walk-around test with a Geiger counter and found that it was a radius of roughly 75 feet. Unknown height to it. Did go on top of the building and got a sink on a reading a couple of pounds per minute. So when the equipment was then turned off, it would just go right back to its rough estimate, maybe 15 pounds per minute or something like that, or ordinary background radiation.
Interesting. Well, one of the things that was associated, or I think now may have been associated, was at around the same time that we were testing the magnetometer, we were also testing an E-field meter. And when the lifter was running, we picked up an 8 megahertz signal. And it was really unexplained. We tested cell phones and the computer in the house and everything, and we couldn't find the source for it. It seemed to be just around the general area of the lifter. And that signal by itself wouldn't mean a whole lot, because the lifter is using a 30 kilohertz flyback, but it may have a harmonic there. But when we turned the lifter off, the signal went back up to 9 megahertz and then fully dissipated. And that was something that was interesting.
My mind, when you just mentioned that, my mind went back to the Los Alamos team who picked up a signal. And I honestly forget what the frequency of the signal was. He said it's an odd signal, and I don't know what it means. He simply told me. I said, I'm not too sure what you mean either. It was up in the megahertz range. He didn't give me the amplitude of or anything, but he just picked it up outside somewhere.
Yeah, interesting. It's one of the things that's kind of further made me wonder if frequency, you know, what kind of a role frequency plays. Although, you know, one of the things I've learned about with the Hutchison effect was, again, since you run multiple equipment at once, and then you have kind of from what you said, a general kind of E-field in the area from the high voltage static DC supplies, it really can be kind of an overlap with harmonic signal also.
Yes, it was a lot of work, and when I made the chance discovery, I thought, what the heck was going on here? I honestly didn't think much of it at the time until DeZero unhappily got involved in the whole military industrial complex got involved, and then I started to get inspired and basically fine-tuned it over years of time and found that the electrostatic energy is extremely important. And also, as we're slowly replacing the Tesla coils with vacuum tube oscillators, especially RF fields and how you present them, meaning that sawtooth formations and amplitude net, and how you present them onto the actual antenna structures. That's why I've always been machining different types of antenna structures, which could be a mass of metal with a geometry to it. It's quite intriguing. But got quite involved up to, well, the time left for Europe in the lab was to follow with me to this special place in Austria. But, of course, then it was taken away by the Canadian government characters against a court order, too.
Oh, okay. Well, back to time effects for just a sec, because that's something that's been intensely interesting to me. But have you ever had the equipment turned off and then had an effect happen either before or after?
Oh, had some strange stuff like that happening. Stuff like stuff turning transparent, the whole building disappearing. It sounds too far out even to talk about, but at least it's verified by the Boeing Aerospace Group.
Oh, so it actually affected the entire building then? Maybe a light effect or just maybe displacing it?
I don't know. It seems to repeat itself, this disappearance, like the Canadian government analysis of the tape shows that these metal samples turn transparent. And the Max Planck Institute, on their analysis of samples, said there's a transparency within the metal grain itself in dense areas. What that means, I don't know. I have the paper somewhere.
Yeah.
And then again, a building disappearing and reappearing, much like it almost sounds like a repeat of the Philadelphia experiment, but, you know, what can I say? I didn't see it happen except the insurance agents and the Boeing group told me this. I said, oh, I'm not aware of it.
Same
as I was not aware of the Super 8 mm film after the government analyzed it. I, of course, got some of those results from DSTI, Dr. Warren A. Kuhn. I'm trying to trace down now to find the actual videos that they took when they visited me in March 1986. So there are some kinds of after effects that happen. And it gets kind of frustrating in some ways because then you get neighbors banging on your door and saying they hear these weird sounds in their home.
Yeah.
We had this problem before. This is happening here, but before, of course, it was people in the industrial area that had housing would get upset and thought we had a huge stamping machine running or something.
Oh, okay.
But I guess they didn't comprehend that there was a lab in there, and they'd leave nasty notes on our door saying, whatever you're doing, it's wrecking our dishes. Alex Zero would cover his mouth and start laughing so hard, and so would I. So, oh, I guess we kind of moved their dishes around or made them fly across the room or something.
Well, I wondered a lot about the Philadelphia experiment, and I was very impressed with, I've always been impressed by the Al Bielek interview that Art Bell did a while ago, but the strange thing was, and I guess there have been a lot of people who have revisited the Philadelphia experiments and said that parts of it are a myth. But the interesting thing for me has been that Bielek's description of the Philadelphia experiment, which actually has corroboration from several people, apparently, the original cultural legend, I guess, that's been around since the 40s, had people disappearing through bulkheads and had metals melting and pretty much a wide array of the same effects that the Hutchison effect has. And the interesting thing for me had been this myth has really been around since, from what I can tell, the 1940s. You know, that's when the story started to really surface about these strange effects. And, you know, it meshes so well with the actual real demonstrable evidence that you have. But I've wondered if maybe the rotating magnetic field equipment or whatever it was they're using might have matched up somehow, created the same effect.
I think so. I really honestly think so, because French did an experiment with a rotating magnetic field at the speed of light within an electrostatic field, got some results in this. So the mystery spot being investigated, but also there's an incident that was investigated by a full team of scientists in Booker Bay, Australia, where people were literally being pushed around by some unknown force, and light would appear from nowhere. Metals would turn soft, and this
Yeah.
Where the government's going there and pouring tons and tons and tons of concrete to keep people away. And because it became such a hazard, just oddly enough, the people would just simply walk in there and disappear. But the Booker Bay one is quite an interesting parallel to use with the Hutchison effect.
Well, I've done a correlation study early last year, and I really started looking at I tried not to really discriminate in terms of credibility. I tried to look at just the entire array of anti-gravity reports, and, you know, including both the ones that I thought were probably bunk and then ones that probably weren't, and just tried to look for common effects that might validate a lot of these. And in some ways, I found kind of rotating magnetic fields as the really the thing that runs through these as the common factor. And a lot of the side effects that I've seen, a lot of the side effects that are reported, again, from people who haven't met each other, don't really know about each other's work, you know, some of them dating back 20, 30, 40 years, others just happening, you know, months or weeks ago, included stuff like a black fog or a black corona. And that was really interesting. I thought maybe it was the light was actually being shifted by a gravity field. The other one was, like the Hutchison effect, tons and tons and tons of lift. You know, these things would take off, and I like to call it real anti-gravity, where not only does it lift off, it takes the table with it. But, you know, really strange effects, and a lot of these seem to tie into the Hutchison effect in some ways. But it's interesting that you mentioned rotating magnetic fields, because that's been kind of a pet area of investigation for me for a while.
It is interesting to take rotating magnetic fields, and for them to travel at the speed of light would indicate something in an Einsteinian equation, I would think, but within an electrostatic field this has to happen. Now, I used to use weak magnetic fields simply to steer the electrostatic energy that was being produced, and I just wanted to steer it in the right direction, basically away from certain equipment.
Oh, okay. So literally just using coils to push ions or, you know, things with a slight charge away from a certain sensitive piece of equipment then.
Yeah, I had a beautiful supply of traveling wave tube guys. Yeah, traveling wave tube units and with huge electromagnets that took just a little bit of power. And I used to start to pull these things too. I guess I got quite involved in the latter years with this stuff, and I guess that would explain why then that within an hour we have maybe five major effects per hour.
Oh, okay.
Some of them lasting up to 15 minutes. We have such things as stainless steel bars being twisted in knot or falling apart. And actually, these things are seen right on video.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of those, and they're very impressive. You know, I've actually had an occasion. I've studied a few different ways to focus scalar fields, and not being really an expert in that area, I've never been sure, you know, what would really work. But I did have one occasion where I was actually attempting to build the Naudan UFO lifter, and it was a very simple design. It was just a corona wire running around the outside of a UFO-shaped two paper plates glued to each other, and I had a flat piece of aluminum on the bottom. And strangely enough, this thing was hanging sideways. And when I turned it on, unfortunately, it didn't create any lift. But what it did create, strangely, I was not expecting this at all, was a directional beam of static. And I wondered if maybe that was one of the scalar effects, where this beam, when it happened, it was initially pointing over my left arm, and it traveled over my left arm, over my chest, and then down my other arm. And I could feel, actually, the hair raising on my body where the beam was pointing, and then when it reached the tip of my right hand, which was on my voltage supply, the supply actually blew up. So I haven't tested it since then because it was expensive to replace, but, you know, I wondered, have you ever tried focusing the scalar effects?
Yes. Sometimes. That was interesting results of what you just kind of described there, too. Actually, we have what we call flame up on a dumbbell tesla coil, and it's V-shaped thing. This cone would appear a black, smoky, fiery stuff, and it go into the ceiling. I mean, I can understand what you're saying about things like that happening to you. We had during the U.S. government test
and smoke particles actually react very well in terms of demonstrating fields. One of the tests that I've been doing with the lifters is actually just using pyrotechnics, smoke bombs, just 4th of July smoke bombs in my case. And if I hold these above the lifter, it will actually do kind of an electrostatic paint job to the lifter. And it works well for TV filming because the crew will come over and the lifter starts out silver. And not only do they get a nice demonstration of smoke flowing through the lifter, but the lifter ends up purple or blue or a mixture of colors. So I've had good experience with smoke as a means of really showing kind of what the electrostatic effects are doing.
That's quite interesting what smoke will do when you put it in there. I remember George Hapley bringing a sample of titanium dioxide. Titanium something or other, or vanadium dioxide, I can't remember. It was a smoke bomb thing you throw in there. And I never used it, though, although when we were filming back way back there with Super 8 MS, we had multicolor stuff coming. Descending all around us. And this is caught on Super 8mm film.
Oh, okay.
And later on, we actually started nicknaming the colored thing that we were floating around, and we used to call him Carl. This red thing would come up from the ground and go through the ceiling. Sounds like some other science fiction movie, but it happened, you know.
Well, you know, one of the things, that, and I guess the Hodgson effect may tie into this somewhat, was... the earth currents, telluric currents, and the way the Earth's magnetic field interacts with these is still a poorly understood area of science. But from my understanding, there are things like, for instance, there's a million volts per foot potential difference between the ionosphere and the ground. And one example that I've seen of tapping this is a 6-foot pole with an LED that you drive into the ground, and it charges for... during the daylight hours, essentially. And then at night, the LED actually lights up. And it doesn't produce a lot of power. And on a cloudy day, you probably won't have any light the following evening. But it demonstrates that, you know, that there are these fields all around us. And so things coming up from the floor actually sound like it, you know, it could be tied into the Earth's natural fields.
Oh, I think so. I've been reading about Tesla's work where he's talking or mentioned the same kind of thing. And using specially treated plates of copper that you suspend in the air. However, our friend, common friend here, Art Bell, has discovered that he can pull out 400 volts direct current of energy with a 1,000-foot loop antenna suspended in the air. And on this 400 volts direct current, he gets a small ripple of AC of unknown origin. He doesn't know what it was. He's telling me on the phone.
Oh, I remember you mentioning that, and I wondered partially. I've heard rumors that Project HARP is up in Alaska. The rumor was, apparently, that they have a nuclear reactor connected directly to this antenna array, and they're putting current to the Earth and the air at the same time. So I've wondered if maybe some of these unexplained effects, not necessarily yours, because you got actually tons of effects before HARP ever went online, but... some of the effects like Art has, I've wondered if maybe, you know, it wasn't some of this energy that the government has been pumping into the Earth. The idea with HARP, from what I understand, is geological testing, although the rumor also suggests that they can shoot down missiles with it. Interestingly, HARP is believed to be a scalar device, and so in some ways, I guess, it would be tied in with the stuff that you work with.
Well, HARP is actually the lifting ionosphere. With the project that was for, actually I'm told it was for communication submarines, and it was used to try and reverse the polarity of the ionosphere, which they actually did, too, according to the ham radio operators.
Oh, okay.
And there's a great danger that if they punch through that and go into the Van Allen belt, that they could cause a Ben Franklin effect that brings down all its energy to the Earth, and stalling the Earth's geomagnetic field. One point I'd like to make, however, too, about these random energy that Tesla and Art Bell and others have discovered, I went back in time and actually copied an old diagram to some ham radio operator. center, you can actually extract a lot of energy from that tree. It picks up the ground waves and then the sky waves out there.
Yeah, you mentioned charging capacitors with that, hadn't you?
Oh, he actually started a Tesla coil, specially made Tesla coil, that had a delay with large capacitors, the old style they used in computers that were around 300,000 microfarads at 26 volts. These things would charge up an amazing amount of energy, were converted into about 14 volts DC, and it would run radios and small motors. That was sort of a side project we'd do before we go on to the main experiments with the levitation.
Well, one of the things that I meant to ask you about, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, was I have an acquaintance who's been playing with smoke detector cells as a means of creating a photovoltaic battery. And I wondered if you'd ever heard of that. I guess Paul Brown had done a lot of research into that. He was born with strontium 90, but apparently there are a variety of different experiments that are out there that utilize these low-grade radioactive emitters. Is there anything that you've done that might tie into that that you could talk about, or would that be related more to government stuff?
I don't know. I've actually, during all my experiments, I used a small radioactive source. And this is radioactive source, which is basically common ore. And I get a reading, pretty strong reading, at least roughly about 2 feet away from it. And then I got more involved into research into atomics, as I call it, and subatomic sciences, and made a special ball to house this material with a milled-out window that was very thin so that I could actually rotate the ball in different directions with this alpha beta.
Oh, okay.
And I had a high voltage source into it that was basically a magnetron that was manually pulsed. And this seemed to enhance some of the effects, and got really involved into it. I thought that, and also Dr. Wilson of DRET, Defense Region Establishment Pacifica, felt that the alpha and beta were being collected into a round ball and carried by the electrostatics to affect the object. Then the other scientist, Dr. Kuhn, said, oh, no, they can't do that. They're always in argument about something like that. But I always use a small radioactive source in the experiments.
Sure. Well, the only reason I mentioned it was, I've heard rumors from the few people that I've met who have experimented with things like that, but I guess the entire principle of the beta voltaic emitter, in theory, violates the idea that radioactive decay happens on a very random basis, but statistically predictable. The device that I've seen could actually be hooked up to an oscilloscope, and once it was primed with just charge from a flyback, it would actually ring on the oscilloscope and produce more energy. So the idea of interactions between electricity and, especially high voltages and these nuclear substances, even in tiny amounts, was kind of an interesting correlation. I've heard that oil companies have patents on these, although, the reasons vary as to why they haven't pursued them. Some people say it's conspiracy theories. More likely, it's probably just they don't know what to do with them. But
I've seen actually patents on a small radioactive source to enhance radio reception. There's certain mil-spec vacuum tubes that have a small amount of radiation in it. Radioactive compounds enhance the electron flows and all that. I have such vacuum tubes laying around somewhere.
Oh.
I've seen a lot of stuff in relation to that, yes. This fellow way back, I think, in the 30s had a patent on a special antenna-enhancing device that used radium chloride, and this would bring in radio signals to the ham radio operators for many times more strength. And I visualize it. I've seen the patent, and I think perhaps it'll probably be in the archives with George Hathaway now. That was quite interesting. There's a lot of stuff with alpha and beta. I actually have a handheld device that's used for detection of electrostatic fields that uses a tritium source of 200 millicuries. And you just simply hold this thing and it'll activate. If you go close to a electrostatic source, it'll show on the meter, this handheld thing that looks like a space gun, that shows you how many ions there are
Well, these are unrelated though to the crystals that you've worked on, right? You have power crystals that produce, from what I've heard, it's an unexplainable energy source, and people have been purchasing these. I guess you sell them occasionally. But they actually, I'm not sure if you're still selling them or if it was just for a few people to investigate.
Oh, no, I'm selling them to the Japanese, sold over 100 of these things. I got involved in that because I was approached by people that were being ripped off by another person who was saying basically that, you know, we have this guy with pieces of plywood with magnets flying around. I said, forget it, you know. Like I said, I can basically, with non-moving power technology, guarantee you a milliamp and one electron volt. So I just basically thought, what would I do if I was on a desert planet kind of situation? Then I made up these crystal converters, which seem to capture all types of energy, converts it into direct current, and it's speculated by the Kyoto Institute of Technology and other people in Japan that they work on zero point. And it seems to confirm it to Dr. Franklin Mead's patent on his unit that collects zero point energy.
Oh, okay. Yeah, someone in a news group once had questioned whether or not those might have some kind of doping that would make them somewhat like a beta voltaic. But I guess in a lot of ways that probably wouldn't explain the output that you're able to produce with them. And now they also glow, don't they? Or is that an LED that you're using to light them up as they operate?
Oh, on the good ones, on the real expensive ones, which were funded by the Japanese and the Germans, they will light up an LED and run a small motor. I gave a demo in Japan in 1995 in Hiroshima City, as the 50th anniversary of one of my units, and basically fired it up and it ran very well. And after the demonstration, without hesitating, I took the thing all apart because what good is a demonstration if you got to show that there's no batteries in it. So with two TV cameras on me, I just went right on it, let it rip, you know, and pulled the thing apart.
Oh, sure. Well,
and then, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, have you ever tested these with the Hutchison effect or when you had the equipment running? And have you added unexplained effects when you did that?
Actually, we did. Actually, these things go back in time to germanium diodes. We used to use them as detectors for the Hutchison effect.
Oh, okay.
And then we got into making our own type of detectors, and we walked around with these things and found that we could detect energy come off the side of buildings, energy coming from nowhere. And then later on, of course, one of the partners took off with one of these detectors and made himself $70 million funding Pinnacle Oil International because they were used for detection of oil, gas, and minerals. And this was also an insult to George Hathaway and Alex DeZero, who had the older version of this, which was a vacuum tube unit that would pick up these same types of energy from the Earth.
Yeah.
Pinnacle Oil is no more because the unit broke down and it all sort of went by the wayside, but the power cells, they do modulate with different, if you walk around with them, they'll modulate. And so that gave you the idea of, well, what kind of marketing tricorder for kids and that kind of thing. Get everything out there without being stopped by oil companies. This is a simple toy.
Oh, definitely. Well, and that, and if they do modulate energy like this, there's always the, even if it's remote, the possibility that you could use it as a focusing or amplifying device for the Hutchison effect, so that the effect that you're able to produce with the equipment then could be projected, in a sense, to a smaller area. And that would be, you know, an interesting idea. If you're ever able to test with larger scale equipment again.
They're fun detectors and also fun for a lot of people. And I would say a rough version of them could be actually had through fair radio sales in Ohio, meaning that there's a compound that sort of emulates it, but it's not as strong as the tiny little batteries they make. It's called barium titanate. And fair radio sales in Ohio used to sell these cylinders. They're about 7 pounds each for $29 all.
know, you also mentioned with barium titanate, what surprised me there is people have been using that in liquors also as a dielectric, I believe. But it's something they've attempted a few times. I've seen probably 10 or 15 different references to it.
Can I mention something rather important that the U.S. government did?
Oh, absolutely.
It's written up in the Electric Spacecraft Journal. What they did, of course, they found that the barium titanate, but they took round balls of the material that were several feet in diameter, and it was very thin-walled. I think it was half an inch thick, if I remember. So what they would do is put four of these balls out in the desert area, and then they'd take a fifth ball of the material and put it in the center of the square, and it would actually levitate itself up off the desert floor. This was a U.S. Army experiment done a long time ago.
Oh, okay.
In the 60s, and it was written up in the Electric Spacecraft Journal. Now, that might have some key info for you, people that are into levitation.
So it was just a small amount of barium titanate, then, that was able to levitate? Am I misinterpreting?
I think Tim, it was pure barium titanate that they manufactured. It was quite an engineering project.
Oh, okay. Okay.
And it was thin-walled, and somehow they were to levitate the fifth ball. It's like if you took the four balls to make a rectangle outside in the desert area, and then put the fifth ball right dead center within the floor of the rectangle, then this fifth one apparently levitated off.
Well, one thing that's, it may be related to this, and I meant to ask earlier, actually, was relating to the rotating magnetic fields. I've seen more and more lately on vortexes, and I guess it relates to a variety of different areas, everything from vortex theories of physics to actual vortex projects. There's an energy cell out there that someone has been working on that apparently uses some of this technology. And I'd wondered if you'd ever worked with vortex dynamics at all, or if that might play a role in some experiments that you've done.
Oh, with the actually make my own vortexes. Is that what you're trying to say, Ken?
Well, yeah. It would be interesting to see. I've seen lots of different apparatus that should make vortex effects to some degree. Some of them as simple as a round emitter in a magnetic field, and then others are much more complex. But it'd be interesting. You know, I've seen references. Nick Cook had mentioned vortex dynamics with the Victor Schaumburg experiments, apparently back in the 20s or 30s. But it would be interesting to see if you'd ever had any effects with those.
I think we did actually have those kind of effects. We had such things as, like, fire things shooting out through the concrete floor. Victor Schauberger actually is quite a hero in Austria. His work is still being actually demonstrated over there. And my ex, who's a filmmaker, her dad was into vortex technology. And I saw the lab, very impressive laboratory, all these types of vortex machines and stuff. So a lot going on in Europe in regards to Schauberger stuff. And, but going back to these fire things that would come out of the floor, it looked like a whirling vortex. And also from the top of the Tesla coil, the previously mentioned flameouts from the dumbbells looked like a vortex. At one time, during the U.S. government test, we went into the lab and turned everything on and found that the energy into all machines was a lot stronger. And every time I say to Alex, I thought I'd ever shut things off because something's not right here. And then I'd turn it all on again, and it would get more energy. And Alex got I got really concerned because the coils were starting to bulge, and extra sparks were happening, huge balls of fire coming out of the stuff. So Pizarro said, go check the mains. And he came back. He says, you won't believe this, John, but nothing's not even plugged in. I said, Alex, you've got to be joking. I said, Alex, come on, stop it. You know, and I went around the corner, and sure enough, all the plugs were out of the coat wall. And Alex said, you got to turn it on again. I said, okay. And then he wanted me to turn it on again, and I said, no. I understand these things, they're going to go, they're going to explode, they'll take this building out. I said, I'm out of here, and I don't think it's wise to turn it on, and you can talk to Colonel Alexander about it, but I'm, this is a little too far. we just had a lot of spooky things happen to us in regards to that kind of thing. Well, that plugged in and still works, and it's stronger. It doesn't seem to make any sense.
Yeah, it is. It is kind of strange. I think, you know, maybe it's related to flickering lights and just ambient energy. Although it's really in the unexplainable category. Well, I'm all out of questions for today. I wanted to say thanks. I sincerely appreciate your time. Is there anything you wanted to say to kind of wrap up? Or,
Well, it'd be really nice, you know, Tim. That's nice talking with you always. And I really appreciate you having the website there, helping me out a bit there and presenting my work. It's just that I wish that of all these videos and documents that there weren't more or less out there for everybody to enjoy.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that, and, you know, and you having a lab, a real, you know, large-scale lab that you're able to really work with these things, that's one of the things that I would hope to see in the future, is that someone, you know, a financier out there or someone with the interest in the capital might be able to help in some way, you know. But you know, just with the renewed popularity of the Hutchison effect, I expect that that's probably something that will come along in the near future anyways. So.
Well, I sure hope so. You know, because kind of not even donate this stuff to some museum somewhere. We'll see what happens. I'm sure that something will, magical things always happen, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, and just to close up, you tend to post in the New Electrogravity group on Yahoo Groups. And do you have any contact info that you'd like to give out to people?
Well, I do a little bit of posting. I'm a bit of a computer idiot. I don't know what I'm doing half the time with computers and groups and that. But I do post, I manage to post quite well on Rumor Mill News. I have a site there. And I post different topics I feel that people would be interested in. Could be anything from engineering to machine tools to electrogravitics or something interesting somebody says. And it's Rumor Mill News Agency, where people can go there and check out my forum.
Oh, okay. Well, thanks again for your time, John. And I'd definitely like to interview you again at some point in the future. But, you know, again, I sincerely appreciate your time and your thoughts. And on behalf of pretty much everybody who's ever seen your videos, thank you for doing the work that you're doing.
Oh, thank you for encouragement. You guys keep away at it, and you'll discover amazing things, I guarantee it.
Okay, thanks again.
Okay, Tim. Take care.
Okay, bye.
Bye now.